I invite you into the spirit of prayer and meditation. Spirit of life and love, we gather in the sanctuary of memory and of presence. We are grateful to be together in this sacred time, in this hallowed space, to hear the heartbeats of one another, those sitting next to us, and the echoes of those long past. We think of all for whom candles were lit and memories resonated and hopes resounded. For those in our midst who have passed on, for dear ones, for loved ones, and in gratitude for those who have moved through illnesses and have found themselves on the other side in a state of health. We are ever grateful for our youngsters, for their love, for their compassion, for their actions of justice. May they continue to grow in spirit and in deed. And we think of all in our world who are downwind of violence, the violence of war, of other conflict, of disagreements that seem unreconcilable until the last resort of violence is sought. And we ask that all of us might be in solidarity, in love and compassion, with all who are hurting and all who are suffering and with all who are healing. May we join our spirits in love, and may we take heart and lessons from what our children show us in the different images of the sacred, reminding us that we need not think alike, draw alike, sing alike, be alike, to love alike. Amen. Our ancient reading is from the book of Exodus 3, verses 13 and 14. In the Old Testament or First Testament, the book of Exodus, we read about the birth of Moses and the strange series of events that brought him to the house of the Pharaoh after being discovered in a floating basket off a riverbank by the Pharaoh's daughter. Moses the Hebrew became a child of privilege, unlike his siblings and his birth people, who were slaves in the land of Egypt. All was on an even keel until Moses grew into a young man who grew curious and went out one day among his birth people, where he witnessed their horrific lot. When he saw an Egyptian striking a Hebrew, he slayed the Egyptian, a radical act that soon came to the attention of the Pharaoh. Moses fled. Ending up in the land of Midian, he married and started a family. Years passed, and the king of Egypt died. The captive Hebrews cried out for help. They had suffered long enough. One day Moses was out tending the flock of his family, and an angel appeared to him in a flame out of a fire in the midst of a bush. It burned but wasn't consumed. How could this be? Such was the medium through which God spoke to Moses and declared himself the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And such was the occasion for God to declare to Moses that he had heard the cries of his people, and that Moses should go to the Pharaoh to bring them out of Egypt. Moses was not exactly eager. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the sons of Israel out of Egypt? In other words, who, me? God reassured him. And this is where it begins from the book of Exodus. Then Moses said to God, "If I come to the people of Israel and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' what shall I say to them?" God said to Moses, I am who I am. And he said, say this to the people of Israel, I am has sent me to you. Our modern reading is from The Cathedral of the World, a Universalist Theology by Forrest Church, one of this age's eminent theologians. He grew up Presbyterian and became Unitarian Universalist, and I believe I mentioned earlier that he was my friend and my mentor. For 30 years, Forrest was senior minister at the Unitarian Church of All Souls in New York City, and it was under Forrest's mentorship that I became a Unitarian Universalist minister, and with the great support of this congregation. Though it was through the love and nurture and support of this congregation, as I mentioned, that led me to that opportunity. Forrest wrote more books than many people have read. He used to get up at 3 a.m. and walk over from his home on East 80th Street to his study at All Souls and write until dawn. One of his last works, and if I could suspend my disbelief, I would claim that he's still writing, was an expansion of a lifetime of thought on universalism and how he understood it for the 21st century. I offer you this morning one of many poignant passages from his work, published after his death just 4.5 years ago. God language, he wrote, can tie people in knots. In part, that is because God is not God's name. Referring to the highest power we can imagine, God is our name for that which is greater than all and yet present in each. For some, the highest imaginable power will be a petty and angry tribal baron ensconced high above the clouds on a golden throne, visiting punishment on all who don't believe in him. But for others, the highest power is love, goodness, justice, or the spirit of life itself. Each of us project our limited experience on a cosmic screen in letters as big as our minds can fashion. For those whose vision is constricted, illiberal, narrow-minded people, this can have horrific consequences. But others respond to the munificence of creation with broad imagination and sympathy. Answering to the highest and best within ourselves and beyond ourselves, we can draw lessons and fathom meaning so redemptive that surely it touches the divine. A 9-year-old boy is out playing with his dog. Tao, the dog, runs off into high grass. Matthew Berger, the boy, chases him. Matthew runs hard, and then he trips. Probably a log, he thinks. But he stops, looks down, and is suddenly wild with excitement. Dad, I found a fossil, he yells to his father. It was August 15th, 2008. The setting was South Africa, just north of Johannesburg, in a town called Cradle of Humankind. Honest, that's the name of the town. Matthew's father is Dr. Lee Berger, an American paleoanthropologist, who had been searching for hominid bones just a hill and a half away for 2 decades. What Matthew had found was a clavicle of a new species of hominid, a prehistoric form of mammal, who were erect and bipedal, and yes, one of our ancestors. Dr. Berger was ecstatic. I trust that Matthew's dog, Tao, turned around to see what all the fuss was about. Matthew had found the partial remains of a young boy, perhaps a year older than Matthew himself. Since then, Dr. Berger and his colleagues at the Institute for Human Evolution at the University of which Watersond in Johannesburg, have found more of the boy's skeleton, including his remarkably preserved skull. And they found the remains of three other hominids, all lived close to 2 million years ago. As reported in the journal Science shortly after the discovery, Dr. Berger and a team of scientists said the fossils from the boy and a woman were a surprising and distinctive mixture of primitive and advanced anatomy, and thus qualified as a new species of hominid, the ancestors and other close relatives of humans. As for the ancient child, the children of South Africa were invited to enter a contest to name him. The Standard Bank of South Africa offered prizes in the form of generous funds for the winner's education and for science education at that child's school. 15,000 children submitted their entries. Young Matthew Berger sat on the judging panel. Omfametsi Kipili, a 17-year-old student from Waverley, Johannesburg, received the honor of naming this ancient child. He would be called Karabo. In the languages of Setswana and Sotho, it means answer. Karabo was the answer to so many mysteries. A child had discovered a child who would be named by a child. In Cradle of Humankind, on a sunny August morning just a few years ago, a boy chased his dog. If young Matthew could have leapt roughly 2 million years into the past, he may have met a strange counterpart to himself, standing upright on two legs, but with features that would have startled Matthew and his dog. Rarely do we as humans see and touch our beginnings, as did Matthew. For his father, it was a moment of spiritual ecstasy. Now, why call it spiritual? Wouldn't we more accurately describe it as a moment of scientific ecstasy? Hold this thought for a few moments. We'll come back to it. Now, imagine yourself snuggled into a seat at a familiar cinema, maybe the Claridge. You're intrigued by a new film that's come out, God the Movie. Reviews have been mixed, but reviews on God have always been mixed. Popcorn in hand, you're ready to see for yourself. The theater darkens. You survive the previews. You are about to see an image of God projected. You're about to witness yet another imagining of God. In a clear, legible script, the film is announced with the names of producer, director, and a few of the actors God is missing from the credits. The background graphic is a scene of tall, wind-blown grasses under a morning sun. Wind suffices for the initial soundtrack. The film begins. A dog appears, barking playfully. A boy appears, chasing his dog. You get the picture. It is with this story of Matthew and Tao and their romp in the grass and what comes of it that I would begin God the Movie, a quite literal projection of one image of God. Why? Because this story embodies transcendence in the everyday. There are no miracles. There is nothing supernatural about it. It recounts the chance discovery of something extraordinary by a child at play, albeit a child who tripped over what he was savvy enough to recognize for what it was, and a father whose professional passion was the search for hominid remains. Dr. Berger had even written his doctoral dissertation on hominid shoulder bones, of which one is the clavicle, precisely the specimen found by his son. I suppose we could see it as an episode of The Twilight Zone. in the light of day. But this story is no more twilight zone than God or whatever or however we imagine God to be. One doesn't have to be an avowed deist or theist to understand that there is a life force at play in the universe. God is a name common to what much of humankind calls this life force. I like the way my friend Forrest Church referred to God as that which is greater than all and present in each. Is this supernatural? I don't think so. Is it extraordinarily natural? I believe it is as natural as the extraordinary epiphanies of life, as natural as breath. Breath, a translation for the Hebrew ruach, spoken in the second verse of the first chapter of the biblical book of Genesis. And the Spirit of God was moving over the face of the waters, which could also be read, and the breath of God, or the wind of God. Like the wind moving through the tall grasses in the opening scene of what I imagine as God, the movie. Such an opening scene confounds popular notions of God as supernatural, that is, non-natural. Such notions give rise to the definitive proclamation that there is no God, that it's all nonsense. Nature is, God isn't. What I can breathe and touch and smell and taste and think and feel is real, God isn't. Theology and literature and often cinematography commonly play into this supernatural, non-natural notion of God, a small God in the vastness of what is even imaginable. According to the late Unitarian preacher A. Powell Davies, such a notion is resisted because the wrong question is asked, implicitly or explicitly. That is there a God? And in Davies' words, folks who ask it bring before their minds the image of a majestic personage, an image which prevents them from seeing the reality at which they should be looking. Such an image suggests a far different God the movie, but indeed one that is a projection of an image wrought by the mind, though a radically different image than that of a boy chasing his dog amid wind-blown grasses. Davies claims that thinking of God as outside ordinary experience assumes an external reality that we could not possibly know anything about, because our minds function within the reality that is nature. How can we imagine, he asked, anything that is not known to us in the natural world? What we should be asking, he contended, is not whether there is a God, as though God could be something outside everything else, but what it is of which we have experience when we feel the power of truth, or the claim of justice, or the sense of beauty. Now let's return to what I promised we would get back to. Matthew's father, in his moment of recognition. The moment that he knew the import of what his son had discovered, a moment of spiritual ecstasy, and yes, a moment of scientific ecstasy. Do we doubt that Dr. Berger might have cried an instinctive, "Oh my God!" Not in deference to some majestic personage, but in wonder, in awe, in over-the-top delight. His spirit was moved within the embrace of his mind. His mind was moved within the embrace of his spirit. The spiritual, proclaimed Davies, is completely real. There are countless notions of God and spirit, countless notions that counter what I'm suggesting, what Davies suggested, and what my dear friend Forrest suggested. God the movie holds the possibility of the countless projections humans have cast onto the screens of our thoughts and imagination since we could think and imagine. Last autumn, Reverend Mark Kiemba, pastor of New Life Kampala, a Unitarian Universalist congregation in the capital of Uganda, was an extended guest at the Unitarian Universalist Church in Meriden, Connecticut, where I have been the minister for the past year and a half. Mark was also a guest in my husband Dan's and my home in nearby Middletown. Dan and Mark and I reveled in dinner conversations that ran late into the night. Our topics ran the gamut, but always seemed to come back to religion in its many manifestations. Inevitably, our conversation turned to our concepts of God and the related perspectives of belief, non-belief, and disbelief. Within the Unitarian Universalist faith, God is big, observed Mark. My imagination of God is which God? I can't understand God in only one context, he continued. Mark, by the way, was not among my colleagues who expressed astonishment that I would ever choose to speak with the Unitarian Universalist congregation on this topic. Mark exuded an ease with the word, name, notion, from which so many of my colleagues adopt a stance of avoidance, disdain, or, oh my God, you've got to be kidding. I guess there's some common denominator in how we use the term. Karen Armstrong, one of the most original scholars of our time, challenges assumptions of all kinds, including the religious. In her arresting work, A History of God, she remarks, in the same tenor as Davies and my friend Mark, that the statement, I believe in God, has no objective meaning as such, but like any other statement, only means something in context when proclaimed by a particular community. The notion of God varies across community and changes across history. Without this flexibility, observes Armstrong, it would not have survived to become one of the great human ideas. And she continues, throughout history, men and women have experienced a dimension of the spirit that seems to transcend the mundane world. Indeed, it is an arresting characteristic of the human mind to be able to conceive concepts that go beyond it in this way. Transcendence is a human notion, a natural notion. It is our experience of the extraordinary, fully within the scope of the real, the natural. Some call it God, but even in the Judeo-Christian Bible, there are many names, so many names. In the lyrics of Brian Wren that we sang earlier, we bring many names. In the poetry of Nancy Schaffer that we spoke earlier, she who prayed wanted everyone to feel included in her prayer. So she said right at the beginning, several names for the holy, spirit, holy one, mystery, God, spirit of life, spirit of love, ancient, holy one, and also spirit of this earth, and my favorite, one who is an entire ocean of compassion. Onto the screens of our wonder, our imagination, our hopes and fears, our dreams, our beliefs, and our disbeliefs, we each project our own version of God the movie. Netflix couldn't possibly carry them all. Imagine that you're back at your local cinema, tucked into your seat, watching my version. You know the opening scene. But a couple of hours have passed, or so you imagine. You've long since forgotten your popcorn. Up on the screen, you're watching what might be a young child running through tall grasses, chasing what might be a dog. But this child doesn't look any more like the young boy we met in the opening scene. Then the young boy of the opening scene looked like the child who was once far more than a clavicle. After all, 2 million years have passed. As this new boy form runs through tall grasses in pursuit of something resembling a dog, he suddenly trips. He is face to face with an ancient counterpart, the remains of a child whom the children of his time named Karabo. Answer. The remains of a child who discovered Karabo. The answer. May the wind, the breath, the spirit of life, the God of many names never cease to astound us in the endless bounty that is life, with its countless questions and astonishing answers. Amen. Now is the accepted time, not tomorrow, not some more convenient season. It is today that our best work can be done, and not some future day or future year. It is today that we fit ourselves with the greater usefulness of tomorrow. Today is the seed time, now are the hours of work, and tomorrow comes the harvest and the playtime. May the prayers of our hearts and the songs of our lips shared in this holy hour of worship be with us now and in all the days to come. As we extinguish our chalice, our worship is ended. Let our service begin.